90s. Midstream.
The results of the Lebanese parliamentary elections reflect changes in the country's political map. Three indicators are being monitored a week after the final count of these results. The first relates to the international position amid confusion about whether Lebanon is waiting for a new initiative led by France or whether it will be left alone in the face of the economic crisis accompanying a political debate that is expected to expand in light of a Saudi intervention that pushes some hot-headed people to continue the political battle against Hezbollah. The second indicator is related to the constitutional entitlement related to the election of the Speaker of Parliament amid a wave of pressure aimed at boycotting the vote for Speaker Nabih Berri and isolating the most prominent and possibly only Shia candidate by electing him with votes that are much less than half the number of deputies. The third indicator is a determined attempt by groups speaking in the name of change to enter into a populist revelry based on the idea that the logic that accompanied the October 17 uprisings in Beirut should continue within the parliament, while spreading an exaggerated atmosphere to prevent any opposing discussion between the elected representatives. The elections for the parliament speaker became the main talked about event in the past week, after parliamentary blocs and representatives of the opposition forces announced their refusal to vote for Nabih Berri, which makes the session a merit that will not pass as smoothly as in past years, especially since the votes that Berri is likely to receive will be the lowest since 1992. It is feared that this new crisis will reflect paralysis in parliament, similar to what was happening in the government formation and the race for presidency. The problem lies in the origin of the session, which needs a quorum of 65, as the election in the first session requires an absolute majority and a relative majority in the second and third session and beyond. Well-informed sources feared that the representatives of October 17, also known as NGO MPs, and the political blocs that refused to elect Berri would boycott the session, which would prevent a quorum, leading the country towards parliamentary paralysis. Simple math guaranteed votes close to 50 from Hezbollah and its allies, and from 9 deputies from the Progressive Socialist Party, also known as Walid Jumlat's bloc, which is likely to give all its votes to Berri. While attention remains on the position of the Free Patriotic Movement, also known as Jobran Basil's bloc, which has not yet been decided. Serious effort has begun, in which Hezbollah is leading, to reach a formula with the Free Patriotic Movement to secure an electoral outcome for Nabih Berri, provided that the movement's share in this settlement would be the position of Deputy Parliament Speaker. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. Tension still prevails in the political discourse of winners and losers in the aftermath of the Lebanese parliamentary elections. It is not likely that the duels between all parties will stop in the intervening days of the first session of this new parliament, which will witness the elections of the parliament speaker according to an unresolved conception, unlike what was the case in all previous sessions since 1992. This does not mean that the speaker, Nabih Berri, will not be the candidate for the position. But the position of the elected representatives do not indicate an easy majority, as per the usual, which opens the door early for discussion about the nature of the political fronts that will arise in the post-election stage. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamzeh Al-Khansa, journalist at Al Akhbar newspaper. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hamzeh. Now, forming a national unity government has always been the concern of Hezbollah, whether before the elections or afterwards. Between the rejection of the opposition forces and their blackmail of the Free Patriotic Movement, it may be too early to predict the fate of this government, whether it will fail or not, before the winners, the newcomers to the parliament are positioned. They choose their position and their options are pretty well determined. How do you assess the results of the May 15 parliamentary elections in Lebanon in the sense of parliament majority?
The stance of Hezbollah and the resistance bloc inside the parliament, whether in 2018 elections or this latest one, has always been one that calls for a unity government in Lebanon. This stance has always been steady, whatever the election results were, whether in favor of the resistance or not. In the 2018 elections, the resistance bloc had the majority in parliament, and they still called for a unity government. However, the opposing parties had the exact same position they have today, which is a complete refusal to take part in a unity government. Today, after the final results of the 2022 elections were announced, we see that the parliamentary blocs have been divided into several diversified blocs. Despite this diversification, Hezbollah, Amal, the Free Patriotic Movement, and their allies still outnumber the opposing deputies. I cannot say they have a majority in all internal issues to be voted about in parliament, but there is a new terminology in Lebanon that explains the situation. There will be political agreement as per each case being discussed alone in parliament, case by case. Most probably, this will be the process that will be visible in the Lebanese parliament. Yet, we should keep in mind that the new deputies who emerged to power, who called themselves the Independent Bloc, added to the Samir Jaja's Lebanese forces, they both raised the same anti-resistance slogans that directly targets the Lebanese resistance, its existence, and its weapons. This team will most probably keep on pushing this political confrontation. The statements issued by these groups since the elections results were out indicate that they refuse to collaborate with any resistance forces to solve the crisis in Lebanon or to meet national merits, on top of which is the elections for the position of parliament speaker.
Well, Mr. Hamzeh, the parliamentary elections have indeed ended, but the Lebanese and Lebanon has actually entered into a new crisis, maybe open to unknown directions this time. As you just mentioned, that we don't have a majority. It might be by peace, as you just said, but the first of these is not the elections of the speaker of the parliament, nor later on the government, and later after that the presidential race. But beginning with the position of speaker right now, how do you think the cards will be played out, since Nabih Berri might have the least amount of votes since 1992?
Concerning the candidacy of Nabih Berri for the position of parliament speaker, it's nearly confirmed that he will get the necessary votes to win the position. However, the question this time is about the process in which he will gain those votes. As you mentioned, the opposing parties are counting on providing the least number of votes for Nabih Berri, an attempt to serve a blow to the resistance camp in Lebanon. They also want to send a direct message concerning the deputy parliament speaker position by securing a higher percentage of votes to the deputy position than that of speaker position. The deputy is traditionally held by a member of parliament from the Orthodox sect. These are the tactics being discussed today. Jaja's Lebanese forces have their own candidate for the deputy speaker position. So that the Free Patriotic Movement, also the new independent bloc, are yet to get together and choose a candidate. There's a complete package being currently discussed when it comes to parliament speaker elections and his deputy. The high-pitched statements we hear from different political blocs in Lebanon indicate a process of negotiations happening in the country concerning the party which will secure the big deal. when it comes to the position of deputy speaker, a deal which constitutes giving Maronite votes to Speaker Berri in return to secure Shia votes from the resistance bloc toward the deputy speaker position.
Well, but it seems that something interesting happened just after the election results were announced, where the head of Hezbollah loyalty to the resistance bloc, Haj Muhammad Ra'ad, who is a member of parliament, again now said about the formation of a national government and the need for the other party to accept it as not to lead Lebanon into the abyss. And his reference to the civil war came to prove that what has been previously proposed since the renewal of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Allah's insistence on a unity government. The opposing parties are openly refusing this. Are we at a violent crossroads for Lebanon? Is this why he mentioned the civil war?
Before we get to the point of predicting a stage of violence in Lebanon, let us be clear that everyone in Lebanon agrees that there are new deputies who have recently arrived to the parliament, who hold new approaches unprecedented in the history of the Lebanese parliament. This new scene was expressed during the electoral campaigns of these new deputies. They hold blatant unseen before positions concerning their readiness to build ties and normalize with the Zionist entity. On the contrary, this same new bloc has a big problem with a main Lebanese political component, that is namely the entire Shia sect and the resistance bloc in Lebanon. They simply want to isolate this sect and remove the armament of its resistance. This is a new political current in Lebanon that has openly announced its alliance with the Zionist Israeli entity. This is the specific party whom MP Muhammad Ra'ad was referring to when he mentioned possible clashes with what he called the puppets of the Zionist regime. MP Muhammad Ra'ad said that Hezbollah is ready to cooperate with all sorts of opposers, except those who are agents of the Zionists' entity in Lebanon. This is a very clear and powerful message from Hezbollah. However, we must keep in mind that the U.S.-sponsored project, which these new MPs are part of, will be part of the ruling process in the Lebanese parliament for the next 4 years. I mean specifically the roles of the U.S. embassy and the Saudi embassy in Beirut, along with whatever projects they represent that does not end with normalizing trends with the Zionist entity. Rather, passes through the millions of dollars they spend to secure the arrival of such deputies to the Lebanese parliament by paying a lot of bribes and excluding the Sunni leader Saad al-Hariri from the political scene to ensure the arrival of Zionist puppets to the parliament under the banner of Jaja's Lebanese forces and a small group of puppets who refer to themselves as the independent bloc. Yes, they did arrive through elections, but Saudis had higher chances in mind than what actually happened. Today, all the anti-resistance groups in Lebanon and the region should sit tight and look closely at the election results. The results do not support the ruling of the pro-Zionist blocs. This means they have to accept to share power with those who outnumbered them, or else the alternative to this is a full-blown confrontation.
Well, it is very interesting to see how the political scene is being shifted in Lebanon with foreign intervention, especially Saudi and U.S. Foreign intervention. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Al-Khansa, journalist at Al-Akhbar newspaper, for joining us to talk about these very interesting results. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Erdogan's bargaining with NATO in return for a safe zone in Syria.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In the rams between it and the West over the accession of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance, Turkey found that the most appropriate opportunity to bargain with the West and extract concessions from them on another issue involving the safe zone project that it intends to establish in northeastern Syria. Now, Turkey aims to export Syrian refugees residing on its land to resettle in this so-called safe zone. Meanwhile, Kurdish forces have launched a wide media and diplomatic campaign to oppose the Turkish project and prevent its implementation, describing it as a threat to the country in Syria and to the Kurdish presence as a whole. Erdogan's safe zone slash NATO bargain in this following report.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on the NATO members to support his country's efforts to establish a safe zone on the border with Syria to accommodate refugees and ensure the security of the southern border in return for his country's accession of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance. As soon as Ankara announced its intention to resettle about 1 million Syrian refugees and transfer them from the Turkish interior to the areas it occupies in northern Syria, the Syrian Kurds mobilized against it, considering the project an attempt to change the demographic composition of the city to Afrin and, quote, Arabize it, unquote. The Turkish discourse so far confirms that the project to build alternative residential cities and villages for refugees does not target Afrin alone, but will include also areas in Jarablus, Al-Bab, Idlib, Ras Al-Ain, and Tal al-Abyad. The announcement of the opening of a housing complex with 100 homes in Afrin gave indications about Turkey's undeclared intentions to focus the resettlement plan in this region, where the Kurds constitute the majority of the original population. Erdogan's plan seems like a clear and direct announcement of a deal that Ankara is preparing to ensure field and political gains in exchange for accepting the expansion of NATO and the inclusion of the two countries bordering Russia within NATO. The deal Erdogan is looking for, which he outlined during a meeting with the ruling Justice and Development Party AKP deputies, cannot be considered surprising. It corresponds to Erdogan's continuous efforts to complete the illegal project he launched along the Syrian border more than 3 years ago, with the aim of forming a strip under Turkish control that distances the Kurds from its borders and ensure Turkey's continued control of that region. It is a project that Erdogan has been aiming for since the beginning of the global war on Syria in 2011, when it requested the establishment of a safe zone near its borders, which it was unable to achieve due to many variables, including the Russian position and the Turkish-European and Turkish-American differences, especially after the Kurdish separatists' alliance with Washington in northern Syria and the U.S. military intervention in east of the Euphrates, where the United States occupies Syrian oil regions in the northeast of the country. It seems that the Turkish president, who is facing increasing political pressures against the backdrop of the electoral conflict in his country, in which the issue of Syrian refugees is one of its main axes, is trying during this period to invest all available resources to advance his project, which aims to resettle about 1.5 million refugees out of about 3.5 million by re-exporting them to Syria and resettling them in residential communities along the border strip, which means a process of resettlement and Turkification at the same time.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Mrs. Tahseen Al-Halabi, who's a writer, researcher, and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Halabi. Mr. Tahseen, now, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on NATO members to support his country's effort to establish what he called a safe zone on the border with Syria to accommodate Syrian refugees for his country's approval of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance. Does he even have the approval of his own parliament before he seeks that of the NATO for a safe zone inside of Syria?
Without any doubt, Erdogan did not receive the approval of his parliament for such a move. I believe a lot of Turkish deputies will oppose such a bargain with NATO. However, it would not be a surprise if Erdogan takes that decision all by himself without going back to the parliament. If so, he will be fully responsible for the consequences of such a decision. On the other hand, building some sort of an entity for refugees on Syrian territory, then by all means He has no right whatsoever to intervene within 1 inch of Syrian soil. This exploitation and abuse towards the Syrian refugees should be dealt with accordingly by the United Nations. His bargains and proposals with Finland and Sweden should never be accepted at the backdrop of this blatant violation of human rights, international law, and violation of Syrian sovereignty.
Mr. Tahsin, Ankara also announced that it will not agree to the inclusion of Sweden or Finland in NATO, claiming that the two countries harbor terrorists from the Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK, while it is demanding the extradition of 12 people from Finland and 21 people from Sweden, in addition to canceling the two countries' decision to ban arms exports to Turkey against the background of its incursion, its illegal incursion in Syrian territory. Will NATO approve of such a bargain with Erdogan?
I don't believe so, because these states have historic ties with the Kurds in Iraq and the Kurds of Syria. Then the U.S. came along and became included within these ties as well, by using the Kurds in Syria against their own country and nation. Such important issues would not allow Finland and Sweden and the NATO to end their relations with the Kurds, whether in Iraq or Syria. The U.S. now controls the fate of the Kurds, known as SDF, in northeastern Syria. Along with the U.S. is the U.K. and France and Italy and the rest of European countries. They want to keep using the Kurdish issues to pursue their goal of fragmenting Syria and to offend its independence and sovereignty.
Mr. Halabi, Erdogan is trying to invest all available resources that he has and positions to provide a boost to his project, the Safe Zone inside of Syrian territory, which aims to resettle about 1.5 million Syrian refugees by exporting them to Syria and settling them in residential communities in northern Syria with financial support from many parties, namely from Qatar, which includes Turkish schools, Turkish institutions and hospitals, which means a process of settlement and Turkification. At the same time, do you think this Turkification process will be applicable, knowing that the Syrian government is yet to finalize the northern part of the country militarily?
I believe that all what Erdogan wants to achieve by exploiting the Syrian refugees will not be applicable. Why? First of all, because Syria, with all its resources, will resist and reject such a project with all available means. Turkey is not an external party that had no role in the war on Syria, the invasion and the violation of Syrian sovereignty. Therefore, Erdogan does not even deserve to play the role of the savior of Syrian refugees by attempting to resettle them inside Syrian territories. On the contrary, Erdogan is attempting to seize further land in northern Syria. Erdogan has expansionist goals inside Syria. He seeks to keep on pushing to achieve such goals. I believe that Erdogan will have to confront the Turkish people themselves, who openly oppose such expansionist policies, which exploits helpless refugees for the sake of balkanizing Syrian land. Also, Syria and its allies won't accept such a move by Turkey. Neither will Russia, which sponsors the Astana talks and always reassures the importance of Syria's sovereignty and independence, and not be exploited by any foreign power. Russia considers that any presence of Turkish forces on Syrian land is an illegal presence. Syria will never accept the continuous presence of Turkish forces or U.S. forces on its soil. I believe Erdogan might plan to exploit the refugees, but even the refugees will not accept those kind of control from Erdogan. Why should they, when they can simply return as free citizens to their land, after Syrian President Bashar al-Assad issued a presidential amnesty decree towards 80% of all criminal or terrorist acts by any Syrian national. This amnesty allows for all Syrian refugees to return to their homeland free from anyone's control. Erdogan wants to bypass every Syrian attempt to bring back its citizens safe and sound to Syria, to rebuild their country and live in peace with all their fellow Syrian citizens.
المشترك مع كل هذا الشعب العربي السوري.
We'll have to wait and see how this plan of Erdogan will play out and how Russia will have to respond as well as the Syrian government to this illegal approach by Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And thank you very much, Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, writer, researcher, and political commentator, for joining us from Damascus to talk about the recent plan by Recep Tayyip Erdogan to bargain for NATO to expand its membership by getting more land, more illegal occupation inside of Syria. No, thank you very much for your contribution. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for the latest from West Asia on the Mideast Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Roughly 17.3 million people in the United States, including nearly 4 million children, live within a half-mile radius of active oil and gas production, which puts them at increased risk of suffering severe health problems from toxic air pollution. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stansil, a journalist. This article is published under the heading, Map Shows Over 17 Million People in U.S. Threatened by Toxic Fossil Fuel Pollution. Here's the story. Roughly 17.3 million people in the United States, including nearly 4 million children, live within a half-mile radius of active oil and gas production, which puts them at increased risk of suffering severe health problems from toxic air pollution. That's according to the Oil and Gas Threat Map, a geospatial analysis released recently by Earthworks, which collaborated with Frag Tracker Alliance to create a data visualization tool. The oil and gas threat map highlights the shockingly large numbers of Americans impacted by drilling pollution. Ranjana Bhandra, executive director of the environmental justice group Livable Arlington, said in a statement, adding, "Almost a million residents of my Texas county, about half of the population, live less than half a mile from oil and gas operations." The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, said Bhandra must act with great urgency to protect them by issuing and enforcing stringent rules to drastically reduce toxic pollution from existing drilling as we rapidly transition to clean energy and end new fracking. This is the only way to reduce health impacts for extraction communities and slow down the worst climate effects of fracking. Nationwide, about 213,000 square miles are under threat from more than 1.5 million oil and gas wells, compressors, and processors. The overall area of this health threat radius has grown larger than Texas, includes almost 12,500 schools, and is home to 4.7 million more people now than in 2017, fair evidence of the negative consequences of expanding domestic fossil fuel production. Citing a slew of peer-reviewed studies, Earthworks and Frack Tracker Alliance determined that a half-mile radius is a very conservative estimate of the area within which elevated levels of toxic pollution are seen, and the distance within which health impacts have most clearly been correlated with the presence of oil and gas facilities. Dr. Ann C. Epstein, clinical associate professor at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, stressed that living in close proximity to oil and gas development is a threat to public health. Health research shows that the closer you live and the more you are exposed to oil and gas development, the higher your risk of exposure to toxic air pollution and the higher your risk of serious heart disease, respiratory disease, and leukemia, said Epstein, adding, seniors are more likely to die and babies are more likely to be born with congenital heart disease and with complications of pregnancy. As the analysis explains, what threatens the areas, people, and schools on the oil and gas threat map are toxic volatile organic compounds, VOCs, emitted alongside methane. Normally invisible, these toxics commonly include benzene, toluene, ethyl benzene, and xylene, the so-called BTEX chemicals. Using optical gas imaging cameras to make methane, a greenhouse gas at least 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide in the short term, and carcinogenic VOCs visible, Earthworks thermographers have recorded more than 1,700 videos of oil and gas production sites since 2014, including the following samples taken at facilities in the Front Range. The oil and gas industry is by far the largest source of methane emissions and toxic air pollution in the U.S. EPA has proposed new federal safeguards to reduce methane and other harmful pollutants from new and existing fossil fuel operations, but Earthworks and Frack Tracker Alliance describes them as flawed. Fortunately, the groups note they are not yet final, and EPA has explicitly said they will consider strengthening them. According to Earthworks and Frack Tracker Alliance, implementing the strongest possible protections will require EPA to fill gaps on critical issues such as frequent inspections for smaller wells and a ban on routine flaring when it finalizes the rule later next year. These must be strongly addressed before the proposal is finalized to ensure EPA is protecting frontline communities from pollution and meeting this moment to tackle the climate crisis. Anything less is a missed opportunity that could have dire consequences. Adding to the case for rapid decarbonization, another study published last week found that slashing air pollution emissions from energy-related sources would prevent more than 50,000 premature deaths and save $608 billion per year in the U.S. alone. The oil and gas threat map, meanwhile, shows 17 million living, breathing reasons to strengthen EPA's methane proposal. Lauren Pagel, Earthworks director, said, pollution-prone oil and gas wells should not be exempt from frequent monitoring, and no company should be able to burn off methane as waste, Pagel added. But no matter how strong these rules are, climate justice during a climate emergency means using every tool in the toolbox, including declaring a national emergency on climate change.
8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
It was the second longest war of the 20th century after the Vietnam War. Physically imposed on this country on September the 22nd, 1980, the Iraq-Iran War took 8 years. A major turning point on what could have been ultimate victory for Iran came in 1982. That was ultimately thanks to Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, which on May the 24th, or Khordad the 3rd, liberated the southwestern port city of Khorramshahr. That's county seat of oil-rich Khuzestan province bordering Iraq. They lost their lives or lost their loved ones, with their hometown turning into a museum city. That's the people of Khorramshahr, known for its resistance and war. Khorramshahr has no less than 25 spots noteworthy of war tourism. This Holy Defense Museum, or Sacred Defense Museum in Tehran, is a reminder of its losses and victory that ensued from a nation's resistance and the military's strategizing. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. On the 40th anniversary of the victory of Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, or Operation Jerusalem, we'll be hearing of technicalities that guaranteed its success. For that, I present a major architect of the operations, although he talks of them in the context of earlier operations. That would be Mr. Bakhtiari, General Bakhtiari, who joined us in Press TV studios. What I'm asking is that you give me some military technical details of the Beit al-Muqaddas operations, because they did become operational. How accurately had you planned them?
Beit al-Muqaddas farzand amaliyat fath al-mubin.
Operation Beit al-Muqaddas is birthed by Operation Fath al-Mubin. Fath al-Mubin is birthed by Tariq al-Quds, and Tariq al-Quds is birthed by Sa'am al-Amme. And they are all the children of the army's efforts in the first year to stop the enemy's war machine. So Beit al-Muqaddas was a form of mindset or estimation that I'll do so and so once I've done so and so, but not in detail, rather from the standpoint of general pre-planning. So officers and those working on this plan started on preparing this plan once former plans made a breakthrough. If I say too much, you'll think I'm bragging about my work or job. But it's actually a truth foreign military experts also agree on, that Beit al-Muqaddas were special operations for execution and given the difficulty and detailed planning they took. And they refer to the fighting ability of warriors on the ground, because architects plan for those on the ground to execute, executing which is as good as playing with their own lives.
The trigger to all counteroffensives was pulled some 42 years ago on September the 22nd, when Iraqi forces launched airstrikes on Iranian air bases, following up with a ground invasion of Khuzestan. With Iran taken somewhat by surprise, the invasion was initially successful and Iraq captured Khorramshahr and made other territorial gains by November. But then came Iraq's turn to be taken by surprise. Contrary to expectation, it was faced by resonated resistance on the part of Iranians. While the Air Force takes first credit for spectacular performance in the early days of the war or Holy Defense, the Army Aviation is associated with a majority of operations carried out during the war, especially the operation codenamed Beit al-Muqaddas.
کسی فکر نمی‌کرد عراق تا اینجا جلو اومده
No one thought Iraq had progressed so far. They thought the Air Force had attempted another coup, but saw it was Iraqi planes. There are lots of accounts given Iraq's confidence and complacency. Say Saddam came to the Ministry of Defense. The minister, Antariq Aziz, tells Saddam, "Sire, the country's youth have gone to finish off the enemy, Iran." The film exists. Saddam looks at his watch and says, "See, it takes no more than half an hour."
These armed forces were echoed and backed by popular forces, the revolutionary militia, you could say. In 1981, Iran launched a counteroffensive, and by early 1982, it had regained all lost territory. We went down to Parliament to meet Mr. Saadati, once the Khuzestan Sepah commander and now MP.
Khuzestan Azizmo.
Khuzestan is the most vital province after the capital, and so always has eyes on it. It holds 80% of our oil resources and 20% of our gas, as well as fertile soil and water in abundance. More important are its great people of 5 million, made up of different ethnicities, Arabs, Persians, Lurs, Bakhtiaris, Qanavatis, all Shia. They're living side by side in unity in their border province.
By the end of that year, 1982, Iraqi forces had withdrawn to pre-war border lines, and Iraq conveniently attempted to seek peace. But Iran saw fit to continue till it topples the restless regime of Saddam Hussein.
The Iraqis even said after their miserable defeat that they wanted to make peace. Our imam said, "It was you that started the war, but okay, our conditions for peace are that you admit you were the aggressor and to return borders to their original state." But it was obviously a ruse and they wanted to reassemble and re-attack. But we read this and the war continued with great further victories for Iran. Although the imam said, "Commanders, do not get conceited, as it was God that liberated Khorramshahr."
Why Iraq's Ba'athist president Saddam Hussein decided on a preemptive strike against Iran, thinking it'll take him just 3 days to run this country down, our guest tells.
Saddam had an inherent hate for us Iranians and great prejudice for the Arab race and people of Iraq. Also, psychologically, he had great ambition to lead the Arab world like Jamal Abdel Nasser. But he had several rivals like Hafez Assad, the then Syrian president. In those days, the Pasdaran Sepah or IGC were not organized and the Basij forces neither belonged to Sepah nor were they a unit. Rather, they were local to city districts. The only organized force was the army, and that too had its problems.
Operation Beit al-Muqaddas was an extensive operation pulled off in swathes. The first attack, which was from April the 24th to May the 12th, 1981, utilized approximately 70,000 army troops and IRGC members, then known as Pasdaran. The forces succeeded in pushing Iraqi forces out of the Ahvaz-Susangerd area. The Iraqis withdrew back to Khorramshahr and a week later, on May the 20th, launched an unsuccessful counterattack.
In the great operation Beit al-Muqaddas, the Sepah Aviation, the Sepah Air Force did all that was possible, as did surface-to-air and air-to-surface defenses. They broke a record given possibilities. After all, with sanctions, we needed parts we were not given for helicopters and planes. Those are needed with every few flights, so the men tried to reduce flights, not to have to change parts too often.
The Khorramshahr operation was planned in such a way that the Iraqis, in spite of all preparation, found themselves diving into Arvand Rud or Arvand River to escape. They didn't succeed. The operation was so vast that it covered from 20 kilometers from Ahwaz and Hamidiyah up to Shalamche and Khorramshahr that the scores of soldiers sent in by Iraq were either captured or sent to hell. This is in spite of its heavy bombing of Iran, even chemical bombing. They found themselves to be no match for Iranian soldiers who fought by belief.
Iran responded to the counterattack with an all-out assault. Iranians finally gathered around the Arvandrud waterway, surrounded the city, and began a second siege. It was on May the 24th that, after 2 days of bitter fighting, Iranians finally recaptured the city. They also captured a substantial amount of Iraqi military hardware and 19,000 Iraqi soldiers. Saddam Hussein, furious and shocked, ordered the execution of a number of top Iraqi officers for losing the city they'd invaded. What remains of the war may be the occasional ruins or this reminder, a museum stretched over 21 hectares to recreate the liberation of Khorramshahr and other occupied areas by means of video projections and all sorts of exhibits. But at the time, in the 1980s, it was a very real matter of life and death, of saving every last inch of our soil. It's a select collection we got to visit in the mostly open-air Holy Defense Museum. I doubt there's anything by way of war memorabilia missing there, from helmets to medals to downed Iraqi planes, and even a lifelike figure of General Soleimani were there waiting for the viewing. Anyway, to hear of the war, I had to meet living examples of the soldier.
ما وقتی که عملیات فتح المبین رو شروع کردیم، ما اصلا امکاناتمون خیلی ضعیف بود.
When we embarked on the Fath al-Mubin operation, we had very limited possibilities. Say in the whole operation area, we had only 11 tanks and personal carriers, whereas Iraq had over 700 tanks and personal carriers. To make up for the shortcomings, we had to get creative. Say the brave commander Motawassalian in the Fath al-Mubin operations insisted we must first engage the enemy's artillery, because otherwise, as we got engaged in line, their artillery would shower us with fire. So, as ordered, six of us were selected to detect the artillery. We proceeded 24 kilometers deep into enemy lines, up to the Ali Gherzal Hills, where we detected the artillery and counted to find they had 94 cannons. And we struck the artillery on the night of operations.
Now, there's a pretty big difference between formal military training and tactics and asymmetric warfare, which is how the Sepah or IRGC, Revolution Guards Corps, and popular forces automatically entered the scene with. So it made me wonder how these two forces, the army or Artesh on the one hand, and the IRGC and affiliates on the other hand, work together to pull off operations with such accuracy, meaning the Beit al-Muqaddas operations, basically.
Given different strategies and training and this and that, how exactly did the army and Sepah or IRGC come to terms? How did they coordinate to pull the operations off?
As for planning, well, every operation takes planning, but that too was based on possibilities and not in the style of classical organized armies. It was a tactical difference between Sepah and Artesh, the IRGC, and army. And after the Beit al-Muqaddas and Fath al-Mubin operations, the army functioned separately and the Sepah separately. The army would engage the enemy so the Sepah could attack from another side. Fighting in two camps increased productivity.
We're talking lots of action that bore results, but such an extensive operation couldn't have worked without meticulous pre-planning. Still, according to a senior military commander quoted by the YJC, the Young Journalists Club, the Jerusalem operation or Beit al-Muqaddas operation was a symbol of coordination and solidarity between the army and the IRGC. In this operation, the whole country, including the financial and military resources, the IRGC and army came to the fore. And with the engineering role of the army, all its infantry and artillery units went to work and a historic success was achieved.
Plenty more on a true story that no words are enough to describe. But first, a quick media review to see what other news outlets have said. Here's how they've put it in writing. Now, in 2018, with the sanctions, Iran's military spending and budget took a plunge. But Sipri has shown good improvements from 2021 onwards. However, Bursa and Bazaar claims Sipri has overstated Iran's military spending for years.
CIPRI SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, produces the world's most authoritative data on global military expenditure and the arms trade. The CIPRI Yearbook, a flagship annual publication, offers civilian and military leaders around the world a way to compare military spending between countries and to gauge which countries are investing in greater military power. This year, the CIPRI Yearbook includes some significant statements about Iran's military expenditure, which is estimated at over $24.5 billion. In a fact sheet summarizing key trends, CIPRI's researchers declared Iran increased its military spending by 11%, making it the 14th largest military spender in 2021. This is the first time in 20 years that Iran has ranked among the top 15 military spenders. We've got a piece from the Tehran Times that reads, Iran's advanced military technology luring customers. The drone production unit was opened in Tajikistan's capital at the presence of Iran's armed forces chief of staff, Mohammad Bagheri, and Tajik defense minister, General Shirali Mirzol. The production of Ababil II, an all-Iranian UAV in Dushanbe, is intended to increase defense and military cooperation between Iran and Tajikistan. The factory was built with the assistance of specialists from the Iranian Ministry of Defense. The first essential aspect that this brings to mind is that unlike many other countries in West Asia, Iran is willing to share its technological knowledge with other countries. The fact that Iran and Tajikistan have agreed to strengthen defensive cooperation demonstrates that Iranian defensive knowledge has many potential clients. However, most countries are scared of the world's biggest bully imposing illegal extraterritorial sanctions and hence refuse to work with Iran. However, Tajikistan is showing its affinity to Iran by pledging to cooperate with Tehran. Given that Iran is subject to illegal severe sanctions for importing and exporting defense technology and weaponry, this collaboration will be even more significant. Also, Iran's dependence on domestic technology in creating military equipment is proving appealing to the West Asian market. Iran's cooperation with Tajikistan can serve as a model for West Asia if they abandon their subordination to the U.S. and live in a fearless world. That'll be it for the news section.
Resistance and the reward that came with it, that's winning back one's lands, is not something to just vanish in time. Rather, the liberation of Khorramshahr played a key role in later political and military developments. These altered regional equations, demonstrating how Iran is a new or renewed power in the West Asia region. The war taught Iran that its domestic defense and external operations need to rely on layered defenses and asymmetric responses.
ما همیشه رو پای خودمون الحمدلله ما الان از نظر بازدارندگی تو منطقه حرف اول رو میزنیم.
Today we are number one in deterrence in the region. That's to say we'll really make the enemy regret any attack on us, even if we are not as well equipped. That's because we'll return one missile with 10, as advised by the leader. Hopefully our economy grows as strong as our military capability. But anyway, as an example of our strength in the Beit al-Muqaddas operation, we in the 27th Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade, led by Haj Ahmad Mutawassilian, were at the westernmost point that's closest to Khorramshahr city. Well, Iraq really didn't expect the tactic we employed. Iraq had come into Khorramshahr thinking that we'd complete our operation and just slide into Khorramshahr via an asphalted road for him to massacre us. He even had all his traps and tanks and whatnot laid ready to kill us off. But it didn't happen.
By 2020, the Iranian military was recognized as the eighth largest in the world based on active personnel and suited to pursue a strategy of asymmetrical warfare. This was after the U.S. imposed its maximum pressure sanctions on this country in 2018, limiting our military exports. In terms of overall military strength, the Iranian armed forces ranked 14th in the world as of 2019 out of 137 countries, going by figures presented by Global Firepower. Given sanctions and reduced imports and cheaper hardware imports, Iran has had to increasingly depend on developing domestic technologies for its military needs. This country relies quite a lot on the development of missiles to overcome the disadvantage of having less military equipment. This country is recognized as having the most developed short- and medium-range missile system in the region. As one example alone, it has 300-kilometer-range Shahab-1 missiles. This moved Washington to install a Patriot anti-aircraft system in some neighboring countries to counter possible missile threats from Iran. We've also got a Shahab-3 missile with a range of up to 2,000 kilometers as a deterrent of last resort.
We are now so powerful and independent missile-wise that we can attack any point or vessel anywhere trying to attack us. This is why so many were saying that today is a time for talks and not missiles. But the leader wouldn't have that. Good thing, or the enemy would have swallowed us alive. But our missile was strong enough to strike the American UAV down at the border. Otherwise, we'd end up like Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, and Palestine with US and Israeli planes hovering above. But they just dare not near our borders, let alone enter our airspace. Well, that's because of our strength.
Like we said, Iran's defense budget of 2021 saw a fine rise. But in 2018, with sanctions, this country's budget was reported at more than $13 billion at best, ranking it 18th in the world in terms of military expenditures. The report was by the same Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI.
We are amongst the few 5-6 countries making submarines and UAVs, so we have sufficient equipment for a modern war without wanting to attack anyone. This, of course, doesn't mean anyone can attack us, and when that easily. Examples are the several strikes on Iran to put it in its place, while Iran responded in a way to show it's certainly not empty-handed.
The enemy is using all its might. Iran has grown so strong that in the power club, it sets an example for other countries far and wide. The enemy seeks proxy forces, and its wars are now by planes and UAVs, or in the form of electronic wars / cyber wars, psychological wars, and hacking and spreading rumors in cyberspace, or by satellite programs.
Iran's military strategy is basically deterrent, but in case of confrontation with or by a world power, probably America, Tehran could count on three legs. Deutsche Welle names these as 1. Defense before the border, namely the operation of Quds Force units outside Iran to attack U.S. forces if necessary. 2. The use of long-range missiles to strike further away U.S. targets. Or 3. An attempt to shut down the Strait of Hormuz and send global energy markets into a death spiral. Give or take, since 2020, with some 523,000 active duty forces and another 350,000 reserves, Iran has the largest standing military in the Middle East or West Asia. The active forces are comprised of 350,000 in the regular army and at least 150,000 in the IRGC. The Iraq-Iran war ended in an effective stalemate and a ceasefire after some 8 years and after more than 500,000 soldiers and civilians were killed, to say the least. It was in the spring of 1988 that the two countries agreed to accept a United Nations-brokered ceasefire under Security Council Resolution 598 that finally recognized Iraq as the aggressor, or initiator. Earlier, international organizations, particularly the UN Security Council, had remained silent about Iraqi atrocities in Iran. For an eight-year Iraq-Iran war, the UN only issued eight resolutions, whereas on the seven-month Iraqi occupation of Kuwait years later, it issued 180 resolutions. That'll be it for today, although we should be returning pretty soon with the matter of offense and defense. For now, thanks for commemorating Khorramshahr with us, the city of bliss and bounty, which for its plight was nicknamed Huninshahr, city of blood and sacrifice.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.